This is On Deadline, where the biggest stories, the smartest journalists, and the conversations that matter come together from Odyssey news stations across the country. When news breaks, the story doesn't stop there. I'm Christy Strasser. Let's get started. We haven't talked about the economy in a while, but it continues to be, well, it's strange. Here's Dave Cohen in New Orleans.
Never since 1969 have so few people been filing for unemployment claims. Why? Is it that fewer and fewer people need a job? Or is there something else going on? We wanted to get the chief economist and managing director at High Frequency Economics in here to explain this to us. So, Carl Weinberg, why is it that unemployment claims are the lowest since the 1960s?
The economy is in a place that it never really normally gets to, which is called full employment, where everybody who wants a job has a job. And we see that in the unemployment rate, which is the statistic that most people look at. It's around 4%, 4.3% to be accurate, but very, very low by historical standards, about as low as it's ever been. So when you get to the situation, the economy can't grow anymore because people aren't available to be put to work to make more GDP, to make more economic output. And that's where we are right now. Companies are finding it hard to find workers to do jobs that need to be done in order to make them grow faster, so they can't grow as fast, and they're holding on tight to the workers that they have, so there are very, very few layoffs.
I see.
That's what this claims is all about.
I see a lot of theories, though, that there are still a whole lot of people out there who don't have jobs, but they either don't want them or they've given up looking for them. So this is the actual number of people who are filing for unemployment benefits. Is there something else going on, as these theories would suggest, that there are still a lot more people who don't have a job or don't have a traditional job or don't have a full-time job, but they're okay with that?
Well, the labor force participation rate right now is extremely high, and it's not going up, which is to say we're not drawing a lot of people out of idleness into workingness. A lot of those people are people who are retired, and to be sure, we've seen a lot of retirees coming back into the workforce. A lot of these people are people who previously were stay-at-home people, housewives, students looking for part-time jobs and so on, who are attracted into the job market by higher wages. But there aren't a lot of them, and what we're seeing is that the labor force and the working age population is actually going down right now because of our demographics. And as a result, it's just really hard to find workers. There aren't that many idle people out there.
So what are companies doing if they are having so much trouble finding people who want to work or who want to leave their current jobs to come work for them with such a shallow labor pool and so few people available to attract? What do you do as a company?
Well, for sure, one thing they're doing is complaining, and we see that in surveys like the Federal Reserve's Beige Book. We see that in the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We see that in the National Association of Home Builders. They're all complaining they can't find workers. They have empty jobs, or they don't have enough qualified people to fill them. The other thing they're doing is they're just making people work harder. In economic terms, it's called increasing productivity, putting on an extra hour on the shift or giving somebody more tasks to do, or, best way of all, adding technology to make the people who are there more effective so you can produce more GDP, more output with the same number of people. And productivity gains is the way that we will grow in this situation until something happens and we have a recession and then we have idle people and then it's a whole new ballpark all over again.
So it really is that model of we have to find ways to do more with less.
And that's one of the first rules of economics. Productivity is the secret sauce that makes an economy grow faster. And when you're at full employment, the only way an economy can grow is by increasing the productivity of the people who are working already.
You said that means that we're really at that elusive full employment for the U.S. economy, which doesn't happen very often. How many times has that occurred, and have we been able to successfully get our way out of it?
Well, you know, I don't actually have a count. That's a really good question and one I probably should know the answer to. But usually it happens during wartime When there's a shortage of people, one of the ways we get to full employment is that we reduce the labor force. So it's happened then, but there have been very, very few instances of it. Give me a good research project. I'll look it up.
Yeah, no, and that is interesting that you say it's usually due to some extreme condition that influences our economy, like a war that has so many people participating in the war that we need to pull other people into the workforce. But yeah, I mean, there just aren't a lot of people out there looking for jobs right now, and that makes it very hard for employers. And so they're now, as you said, looking to get everybody who they do have more productive. How much do we have to fear then burnout amongst workers if they're being called on to work longer and work harder?
Yeah, so there are many different ways you can get more productivity out of a worker. One way is to give them more hours of work, increase their overtime, give them extra shifts and so forth. That's kind of the old-fashioned way, and it's kind of what I'll call a brute force way of doing it. Technology is usually the smarter way to do it, all right? We give somebody a computer to help them work faster. I hate to say this because I know it's controversial, but you give a salesperson some AI assistance, and they can then make more calls than they could ever make before because they're more organized. You give somebody who's moving gravel from one place to another, you replace their wheelbarrow with a machine, and then they can move more gravel, probably doing less actual work. So productivity comes into our workplace in many, many, many different ways. But at the end of the day, the idea is to get more output per worker. And it doesn't have to be through a burnout-inducing way.
So, older people are staying in the workforce, but what is Gen Z doing these days? Here's KCBS in the Bay Area.
I have two Gen Zs, and they are socking it away. So why are you seeing this early savings in this group of under 30?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've got the same situation in my life. And, the common perception is that they're all really chomping at the bit to spend money, but it just doesn't seem like that's the case. And I think there is a growing interest with more affluence that people are focusing more on money. And it seems to have caught the attention of Gen Zs that are trying to get a head start on their future financial wealth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a cohort that went through, they came of age when Obama was in office. They went through a pandemic. A lot of them were in college or high school at that time. And they could see that they really need to start stashing money away because maybe their parents won't be able to help them out.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I couldn't really actually tell you why this is the case. It's sort of odd. One kind of perceives that this is not the case when you consider car loans now are stretching out to 6 years and 7 years and 8 years. But I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing not only for Gen Z, it's a good thing for the economy as well, being a little bit more prudent with money rather than just floating on credit.
Yeah. And they're pretty nihilistic about some things, but because they say, my son will say, I'll never be able to afford a house. I'll never have a good enough job to have a 401k and all of that. But they're not nihilistic about this. They really are putting money away.
Yeah, they really are. Even though your son is probably right, he probably won't. Unless he goes and works for a tech company, it might be very difficult to buy a house in the Bay Area. But of course, that's why people are living in Tracy, right? Because they just move farther away. So, I think it's pretty pragmatic on their part. And, in a lot of ways, it kind of actually, I don't know how these two things are connected, but it's just like kids are putting off having children. Mm-hmm. It's the same. There's just some phenomena happening with this age group that is a little puzzling, but it certainly is happening.
Yeah, well, I think they're the ones that are going to change the world, too, the Gen Zs. That's what I always tell my kids. So
I think that's true.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you have some advice for them to get the most out of their money?
Yeah, I think that the way to get the most out of your money really is to take advantage of your employer pension plans. That's where all the secret money really is. For many people, if you work at an employer that has a pension plan, they have something called matching or 401k matching, and that's something you certainly want to take advantage of. So ask your employer what opportunities you have to save. And then just remember, compounding is your friend. It's going to take time to build up a nest egg, but you'd be surprised how fast money can grow with interest compounding.
Mm. I also know that this generation is a generation of gig workers. They're not necessarily going to have a pension because they're moving from job to job and gig to gig. Some other suggestions about how they can save money?
There's all kinds of opportunities to save money if you're self-employed, or as you call it, gig workers, people that don't have traditional jobs, W-2 jobs, or more 1099 employees. You can set up pension plans. You can do self-employed IRAs. There's all sorts of things you can do. But you have to ask about it, because if you're not working at an employer, then no one really is whispering in your ear about these things. So consult a financial advisor. They can give you some of the alternatives available for people that are self-employed. Believe me, there are plenty.
No matter what generation you're in, we all experience the same weather, and it's hot outside. Here are tips on saving some of that hard-earned money on utility bills.
A lot of us are struggling with those electric bills, as hot as it's been, and with the price of fuel, what it's been. And so we wanted to get some tips from an expert. Is there anything you can do to reduce your cooling bill during these crazy hot summer months? Paul LaGrange is host of the Home Improvement Show and owner of LaGrange Consultant. For folks who are looking at these electric bills that are coming in and realizing just to keep their house at some kind of comfortable temperature is costing them an arm and a leg, what advice do you have?
Well, this is definitely a timely message because we are in the thick of summer and it's not going to end anytime soon. So this is what I do at my home, and this is some of the suggestions I will share with others. The fastest, easiest, most effective way, if you haven't changed your return air filter on your air conditioning system in the last 30 days, you need to change that. And then you want to get one that's not too restrictive. When you look at air conditioning filters, you have a number of choices. You have the one where you can hold it up and kind of read the newspaper through it because it's so thin.
Yeah.
That's very ineffective, right? And then you have the pleated filters, and it comes from three different levels of performance. I normally use the one in the middle. If you've been told by your air conditioning installer or service technician in the past that your return filter is too small, use the lower performing, the one that's not as restrictive for return air filter. And you need to change this time of year, Dave, our ACs run so much daytime and nighttime, you need to change it at least every 30 days. Please don't go by what's on the package. The package tells you once every 90 days. That's for folks who do not operate their air conditioning system as long and as hard as we do here.
That's for folks in the other parts of the country where maybe their air conditioner runs 6 hours a day. Ours feel like they're running 26 hours a day.
Exactly. It's exactly right. So first thing, let's get those return air filters changed. Secondly, if you haven't had your air conditioning serviced and it's struggling, it may be time that you pony up a little money for the technician, let him come out, check it out, improve it. Keep your blinds, your shutters, your draperies closed during the daytime for sure to try and keep that heat out. If you have pets or young kids and normally you would leave the back door open so they can go in and out easily, don't do that. Keep the door closed. Open it when you need to. Close it the remaining part of the time. Try not to cook in your house. If there's a meal you can prepare and cook outside on an outside barbecue grill, that would be a great thing, because remember, whatever heat you produce from cooking, whether it's from the oven or the stove, you have to remove with the air conditioning system. So anything we can do to reduce internal heat and external heat coming in, that is what we're looking at, and also the performance of our air conditioning system. If you got shrubs and landscaping all around your air conditioning condenser outside and it's restricting the airflow through that, trim those bushes around it, give us some good airflow. A good rule of thumb is a minimum of 18 to 24 inches all the way around on all sides of your outdoor air conditioning system. If you can get it, the more the better.
Paul, someone texted in and says, Dave, if you dress at home like you're going to the beach, you can set your thermostat several degrees lower. What is ideal for when it comes to where to put the thermostat in terms of the most efficiency?
So from an efficiency standpoint, 75 degrees in the summertime is the ideal temperature. However, most folks find that 75 is just way too warm. And if you're Let me paint a different scenario. If you are sitting down and you're idle, you're reading a book or you're working on your computer and you got a ceiling fan above you, 75 is not bad. However, if you're cleaning the house and you're active, you're moving things around.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
75 may be a little warm, so use your best judgment in reference to that. But you can save a little bit of money by bumping from, you know, 72 degrees, bumping it up to 75. Now you got to do that consistently. The use of fans is something we discuss often. Is that if you have air blowing across your skin, it feels cooler. So the use of ceiling fans where you're in the room is a good use of that. That tool. However, if you got ceiling fans in every room, you're leaving them on 24/7, thinking it's reducing temperature inside those spaces, then you're making a mistake. That is not the case.
Yes, if ceiling fan makes you feel cooler, but it doesn't actually cool the air.
Exactly. Yes, sir. And so be underneath it if you're using it. If you're not going to be in the room for any period of time, go ahead and turn it off.
Yeah, you're just wasting electricity if you're not in the room. What about identifying and finding any gaps in your insulation or any drafts, things like that? How can people efficiently do that to save themselves some money?
So some of the utility companies have weatherization programs. Clico, we talk about this on our Saturday Morning Home Improvement show often. They're one of the sponsors of the show, and they have a weatherization program. So if you're a Clico customer and you're wondering, okay, where are my inefficiencies in insulation and air leaks and duct leaks, they will come do a weatherization inspection and assessment for you. Entergy has a very similar program. So those are the two larger utility companies in the area. I don't know if the other smaller REAs have those type programs. So it's worth calling and asking or going on a website and seeking for it.
All right. Yeah. And that's free. Free. You're paying your bill every month. That's a service they provide as a result of you paying your bill every month and helping out that way. So what else? Anything else I haven't asked you about or any ideas that things people can do to try and at least reduce? You're not going to get down to a normal wintertime electrical bill this time of year, but anything you can do to cut the cost?
No, you're not. However, there are some other steps you can certainly consider. If you have in the process of replacing light bulbs, make sure you use the LED lamps. Don't try and search for
the incandescents,
the older technology.
Yeah, they actually make heat.
Definitely, if you can. They do produce a lot of heat. So do the fluorescents. The fluorescents aren't as bad as incandescents, but they're not as good as the LED. And with today's technology and the color and the temperature of these LED fixtures, it's always good. Same thing with gaming systems. They produce heat. If you're using the gaming system, leave it plugged in, utilize it. When you're done, unplug it. In fact, you'll be surprised from a vampire load standpoint. Vampire loads are devices we leave plugged in all the time that consume electricity even when you're not actually using that device.
Yes, I'm calling it also phantom electrical.
Phantom, yeah, exactly. So, but something simple is chargers for your smart device or your cell phone, gaming stations, electronics, computers, televisions, all these products use these, you know, they draw a little bit as they go along throughout the day, even while they're not being used. So you can turn those off. I mean, if you need to do that in order to reduce the heat inside your house and also the benefit of having a lower monthly utility bill, man, I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea.
So actually,
it's something simple you can do that doesn't cost you anything.
Unplug the stuff you're not using because a lot of them consume electricity, whether they're on or off.
That's exactly right. Yes, sir.
All right, and then I'll leave you with this. If I tell you, Paul, go turn the thermostat up, what are you doing?
I'm raising the temperature, but you're making it warmer. You're making it warmer. I know we get that backwards. And then, of course, we also talk about water heaters versus hot water heaters.
Yes.
So if the water was already hot, you wouldn't have to heat it. So,
although I would say this. Your water heater does keep the water at least warm at all times. It doesn't let it get cold at any time. So technically, a tank water heater is heating already hot water by maintaining it at whatever temperature you set it at, right?
I'll give you that. Yes, sir.
All right.
You know what sounds great on a hot day? a vacation on a lake. Here are tips on making that happen without breaking the bank.
Henry Hartveldt is a travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group and travel industry market research firm. Henry, thanks for joining us again. So if folks have missed out or want to get one last gasp of summer, are there still opportunities out there for people who want to get away?
Yes. Look, if you want to get a summer vacation in, you can. However, you're going to have to work hard. You may be able to get better deals on hotels. Airfares have gone up because of the fighting in Iran, and they've stayed up because, frankly, demand is strong, and the airlines are trying to recoup all the higher fuel costs they've been paying out for the past 4 or 5 months. So to look for a good fare, be flexible, use fare shopping engines like Hopper and Skyscanner and others, and be open to maybe flying into a neighboring airport as opposed to the primary airport, if that can save you money and if it's convenient for you. But there are deals out there, at least within the U.S. It's going to be a little more difficult to get a good deal to Europe, unless you can go after Labor Day and when the airfares start to fall.
I'm going to claim ignorance here. Hopper, Skyscanner, these are tools I've not heard you mention and I've not used before. So I imagine there's other people in that number. Tell us, what are Hopper and Skyscanner and how do they work?
There are a number of different websites and mobile apps that help you compare airfares and schedules across a lot of airlines, sometimes not always every airline, but probably 99% of them. So Hopper is a mobile app. Skyscanner is a website. They also have an app. There's Google Flights. There's Kayak. And there may be others. And what they can do is give you a relative sense of comparison for the fares between airline A and airline B. But here's what I want everyone to be very careful of. These generally default to the least expensive fares, which sounds good until you realize that may include basic economy. Basic economy is heavily restricted. If you're traveling solo, it may be good for you. If you're traveling with a family, or if you think your plans may change, or if you want to be able to choose your seats in advance, it may not be right for you. So just do your fare searches very carefully. Take a minute to make sure you're reading everything. Check or uncheck boxes as you need to.
So with these basic economy, means if you're traveling with a group of four, you may not even be able to sit near each other on the plane, and that doesn't work with kids especially. There's other things like that that you want to take into account.
Correct, because with basic economy fares, the airline assigns your seat at check-in. And outside of something like, you know, traveling with a minor and you're assigned to an exit row where the minor cannot legally be seated by FAA regulations, you can't change your seats. So, you know, now look, if you're going with friends but you really don't care about sitting together on the plane, maybe it's fine. But if you want to be together, it's obviously not the right fare product for you.
You know, you talk about these online tools. We had an interesting conversation last week with Jason Shields. He's a guy who comes on with us for a segment each week from Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. And he was saying there's bots out there now that many of these online tools use that will try to determine before they give you price what you can pay. And often, based on your online profile and economic information, your price may be different than somebody else literally right next to you searching for the same fares. Does it make sense to have different people in your group or family also search to see if they can find a better rate than you can?
Well, okay, first, airlines just aren't that smart. Okay, I'm just going to be real upfront with you. But airline fares can and do fluctuate based on how full a plane is. Are you flying from, let's say, New Orleans just to the hub airport? Are you going beyond the hub airport? What destination are you going to, and so on? So airfares do vary. Now, it always helps to have a trusted friend maybe do their own fare shopping, especially if maybe you're a more casual traveler and your friend may travel more often. It can't hurt just to take a look and see who might get the better fare. But the airlines cannot legal. They are legally prohibited from doing price discrimination based on things such as your a computer browser type or your zip code or your past purchase history.
So that
what airlines.
So yeah, that may happen when it comes to lodging or vehicle rental, but you're saying it's not happening for the actual flights.
Yeah, well, even hotels and others won't, don't do that because, again, their systems just aren't set up yet to do that. Now, what airlines and other travel companies do, they do know consumers' overall willingness to pay. So if they know that from New Orleans to Las Vegas, for example, people are willing to pay at least $120, then that's where they're going to price the fares. But if they know that people will only pay $110, they'll lower the fares. So again, same with hotels and same with rental car companies. They are certainly very sophisticated when it comes to pricing, but they're not using at the point where these bots are able to, if you will, figure out who you are and say, oh, it's Dave. We're going to charge him more or less than we're going to charge Henry.
You mentioned flying into alternative airports, maybe the smaller or the regional airports, instead of flying into the main airport. What about flying out? If you look at, for example, here, if you can compare flights by leaving from a different city, because it's not that far to drive from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, or really, if you can save a lot of money and you're going a long way, what if there's better flights out of Houston? Do you recommend travelers look at those options?
Look, I certainly, if you don't mind the drive from New Orleans over to Houston, absolutely. One thing that helps with lower airfares is the presence or lack of presence of budget airlines like Frontier, Allegiant, Sun Country, Breeze, and Avelo. If you have those airlines in your serving your airport and ideally going to your destination, the airfares may be less than if you don't have a budget airline. And the budget airlines are less likely to serve smaller towns like Lake Charles or Baton Rouge. But, New Orleans, Houston is still a long drive. And with gas prices being what they are, you have to figure out the cost of driving, parking, et cetera, and then add that to the fare and figure out if the savings really are worth that.
Anything else that, as folks may be wanting to just take one last gasp at a summer vacation, or for empty nesters like myself and my wife, maybe we can wait till the fall when kids are in school to travel. Any other tips that you got for folks looking at doing some travel that they haven't planned yet?
Well, one way to save money is to book a package that combines your airfare and lodging, or maybe a rental car as well, together. It can save you 10% or more versus buying those individually. Several airlines in the U.S. have these packages. The online travel companies such as Expedia Group and Booking Group offer these kind of packages, and traditional travel agencies have them. Now, if you're thinking of going to Europe, by the way, this is where a traditional professional travel agency can still be very helpful. They sometimes have access to unpublished fares that airlines don't want to appear online, but may save you more money as well. And as you said, if you are flexible with your time, if you can go after Labor Day, whether it's domestic or Europe or almost anywhere else, you might be able to save some money. In fact, a considerable amount of money.
All right. So if you haven't taken that trip yet this year and you still want to, there are options out there and there are deals to be had. When do typically prices start to dip with demand? At what points in the year are the cheapest to travel?
Well, the cheapest times to travel are during the month of October and first half of November, because that's really when everyone has pretty much taken most of their vacations, and we're ahead of Thanksgiving. There's business travel, of course, but there's not as much business travel occurring now as there used to be before COVID, since so many people can work remotely and they're using video calls and others to do business. And again, a lot will depend on where you're going and when. Vegas is perennially popular, and if there's a convention or a major entertainer or something taking place in Vegas, that will push airfares and hotel prices high. So again, if you can be flexible, and September is too expensive, take a look at October, especially if you want to go to the Northeast U.S. when the leaves start to change. A cruise might be a good deal for you then, also, or Europe.
Anything else I didn't ask you about that you want to share with our audience as they're considering if they can take a trip in this tough economy this year still?
Well, You can still take a road trip. You don't have to get on an airplane to go somewhere. But if you are thinking of going away at Thanksgiving, and I know it's more than 3 months away, but start researching your Thanksgiving trips now to get a sense of where airfares are, just so you can figure out if that's a trip you can afford to take by air, or if you'll need to consider maybe driving.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.